Good day. My name is Jason, and I will be your event specialist today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Trade Secret Protection Best Practices Web Conference. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. We will be taking questions today as time permits. To ask a question, locate the Q&A panel on the right-hand side of the screen, type in your question, and hit send. If you experience any technical difficulties during today's presentation, please submit your question via the chat or press star zero on your telephone keypad to be connected with an operator. This presentation has been prepared by Seyfarth Shaw, LLP, for informational purposes only and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or a legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general information purposes only, and you are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachments, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purpose of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. At this time, I would like to turn today's program over to Robert Milligan. Robert, you may begin.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us for today's webinar, Trade Secret Protection Best Practices, Hiring Competitors' Employees and Protecting the Company When Competitors Hire Yours. My name is Robert Milligan. I'm a partner in Los Angeles. I'm joined today by our national chair, Michael Wexler, who is a partner in our Chicago office. I'm also joined by Joshua Salinas, who's one of our associates in the Los Angeles office. Thank you so much for joining us today. We have an ambitious agenda for today's program. The following topics we plan on covering. First, best and worst practices for hiring new employees and dealing with departing employees. We'll cover interviewing prospective candidates and assessing agreements with current employers. We'll also go over some best practices with respect to agreements, policies, and procedures to put in place when hiring a competitor's employee. We'll also go over one of the most important things that a former employer can do, which is to have a proper exit interview procedure. We'll also go over some strategies for addressing non-compete restrictions and deal with some best practices for those jurisdictions where non-competes are not necessarily enforceable. We'll also go into reducing the risk of disclosure of trade secrets in social media. We're doing something a little bit different with our webinars today. What we have to offer you is something that we think you'll find very useful. It's actually a video presentation put together by some individuals at Seyfarth Shaw. And it is a hypothetical situation of a software company in which an employee from a software company is interviewing to join a direct competitor. And the employee's name is Toby, and he's being interviewed in the video by the prospective sales manager for the new employer, and her name is Grace. And you'll see in this worst practices video some things employers shouldn't do. You should pay particular attention to the interviewer, the applicant, and the current employer. And again, this is the best. This is the worst practices video. And so by this video, we hope to show some educational opportunities for the audience to what not to do in the entrance interview as well as the exit interview process. Now, it's important to note that the video involves employers and employees in California where non-compete agreements are generally unenforceable. But it's important for the nationwide audience to understand that this could be a good litmus test for gauging your own trade secret protections. We understand that in certain jurisdictions, non-competes are enforceable, and we recognize that, but we think that this video elucidates certain things that any employer across the nation should have as far as their trade secret protections, or at least in this worst practices videos, the lack thereof. So at this time, we'll get into the video. Enjoy.
Toby.
Good morning.
Well, Toby, I have to say, looking at your resume, I think you'd be a perfect fit for our company. Your background experience is spot on, your recommendations are glowing, but I want to hear from you. What do you think that you'll be an asset to our company?
Where do I begin? First of all, I have extensive contacts and great relationships with customers all across Southern California. I'd, of course, let them know that I'm changing jobs, and you know, I'm sure they would follow me anywhere.
Yeah, an established customer base. That's exactly what we need during our expansion to Southern California.
You know that accounting firm on First Street, the one with the green and white building?
They must have the worst IT manager of all time, because we've been licensing software to them for the past 3 years at a 20% markup. I mean, I could come in and undercut that price and still make us huge profits.
Wow.
I'd be able to hit the ground running from day one with all this great material from my old job.
Yeah, you know, nothing like avoiding that awkward startup period.
Definitely. And you want to know the most ironic part? One of the last projects I worked on was our plan to slow your expansion into Southern California. I feel like I know you guys already without ever having worked here.
That is ironic. I'd call you a traitor if we didn't want you here so badly, but you really do sound perfect for the position. When could you start?
As soon as you want me. The less notice I give, the less I have to deal with all those awkward goodbyes. And it will light my fire to get as much of my material and customers together as quickly as possible so I can hit the ground running.
Well, today's Monday. Could you start Friday?
Sure. Sounds great.
Okay. I mean, because we're in the sales industry, HR did tell me that I have to ask if you signed any agreements with your previous employer. Do you happen to sign one?
I don't know. I think I could have signed one of those, you know, keep things confidential and don't misuse our computer network agreements, but I don't even really remember what it said. It's probably no big deal. I hear the courts barely enforce those things anyway, so I think it's best if we just not worry about it.
I heard the same thing. So we'll see you Friday. Oh, and why don't you make sure to give a shout out to your customers and let them know you're coming over.
By the way, are you guys looking to fill in positions in your new office? Because I have lots of coworkers who I think would be like a really great fit here. They've been complaining a lot about how management is really going south lately, and I recently worked with a big team in putting together an RFP for a franchisor that's looking to expand in Orange County. So, I mean, we're so far along in that proposal that I would hate to leave the whole team behind.
No, please do. I mean, like I said, the startup period can be so rocky. And if you and your coworkers are already used to working together, that'll make the transition that much smoother.
All right. I will see what I can do.
You really are the whole package, Toby. You've got interesting information, established customer base, coworkers to bring with you, experience in the industry. I'm going to tell HR to get the new hire paperwork over to you right away.
Look at this mess. Where do I even start? Ugh, what to pack. All right, 2012 pricing guide. This could be useful. Oh, yeah, I spent days compiling old sales info to figure this one out. Oh, and these brochures, and these charts, and these cost analyses. I'm going to need a few more boxes here. Oh, my Outlook customer contacts. Of course, I definitely need to email these to myself. Although, come to think of it, I'm already connected to just about everyone on this list through LinkedIn, but I don't know. I guess I'll take the Outlook list, too, just to be safe. I better email this strategy plan, too. There is so much useless stuff on this computer. I should probably clean it up for the next person. Let's see. Control-A, right-click, delete. That was easy. All right, what else? Ah, personal emails and files. It is going to take forever to forward all this. Oh, yeah. I also better let my coworkers know that I'm leaving. Gotta get that franchisor team on board. I promised that I would bring some of them with me, so I better start spreading the word. Ah, almost forgot these. Hello. All right, done. Time to move on to the next chapter of my life. Sayonara.
Hi, IT department? It looks like Toby's gone for good.
I'd like someone to come down and wipe his computer. Hey, can you let HR know too?
My assistant could really use a new computer now that we've got an extra.
Funny how these things work out so well.
Thanks.
We hope hope you enjoyed that worst practices video. As you can see, there was a lot to learn in that particular video. Toby was quite the employee. As far as things that you may have picked up from the video, as far as worst practices, let's first take a look at the interviewer, Grace. Now, again, of course, Grace was from the new employer, and she was planning on bringing Toby over to join her at her software company in California. Now, she made a number of pitfalls in her process in interviewing Toby. First, she didn't steer Toby away from providing customer specifics and information about potential trade secrets. You may recall that Toby volunteered specific information regarding specific customers and specific pricing information. That was not a good practice on Grace's part. The other thing that the interviewer failed to do is that she accepted the bad-mouthing of the current employer. Another thing that you may have picked up is that she encouraged Toby to start in a mere 4 days. So very little notice, if at all, to the current employer. She also told Toby to give a shout-out to his customers. That's obviously going to get the not only Toby, but also the new employer into trouble under either a trade secret theory or a duty of loyalty theory, because you need to recall that at the time that Toby's interviewing, he still has obligations to his current employer. The other thing that Grace didn't do in this video is that she didn't press the applicant for copies of his previous agreements, but instead accepted that Toby either didn't recall whether he had an agreement or that it wasn't a big deal whether or not he had agreement. That's a big red flag. Another thing you may have noticed is that Grace encouraged Toby to solicit fellow coworkers. Now again, Toby has a duty of loyalty to his employer, and soliciting fellow employees while you're still employed is a surewire bet to get you sued, not only Toby, but the new employer. The other thing you may have noticed is that it's almost a foregone conclusion that Toby is going to be provided a job offer. In fact, Grace pretty much goes about saying that during the video. There needs to be effective vetting of the agreement before any offer is made to the applicant. Now, as far as worst practices from the applicant, Toby, he was quite the colorful character. Now, he offers a lot to his new prospective employer. He offers to move customers and coworkers before even leaving his old job. And he shares specific confidential information about customer. And, of course, you saw that he's bad-mouthing his current employer. And he's more than willing to leave his old job with little to no notice. These are all red flags that employers need to keep in mind when putting together their best practices for entrance interviews. You also notice that he's going to bring his old employer, he's going to bring his new employer's or his old employer's materials along with him in order to hit the ground running. So he's not going to return all of his company material when he joins his new employer. And then he also offers to his new prospective employer to bring over additional employees to help him with a project that they're doing in the Southern California area. These are all surewire bets to get the new employer in trouble. Now, some of the actions you may have noticed from the video that Toby took that are, again, worst practices. Not only did he take hard copy documents, but he emailed electronic documents to his personal account, and he took company data on thumb drives. It's also possible that he maintains company information in the cloud storage based upon his comment regarding having his LinkedIn contacts saved. And you also noticed from the video that he deleted files from his company computer. Lastly, you may have noticed that he provided little to no notice to his current employer about him leaving. Now, probably the one that's most to blame in this scenario is the applicant's former employer. And the reason we say that is it's pretty clear from the video that this particular employer had failed to create a culture of confidentiality. And what we mean by that is stressing to employees the importance of keeping company information confidential and explaining to employees how keeping it confidential not only benefits themselves but also the employer, and how it can potentially hurt the company if confidential trade secret information is unwittingly or intentionally disclosed. Now, this particular employer failed to conduct an exit interview. And what we found in our experience is that an exit interview is probably one of the single most important things that employers can do to protect their trade secrets when an employee leaves. The former employer also allows the employee to clean out his office without HR present and take material without reviewing its content. He also authorizes the wiping of the employee's computer, which will destroy evidence that the employee forwarded files and customer contacts to his personal email account, which you may have seen in the video when Toby was leaving his office. And finally, the former employer generally appears unconcerned about the abrupt and unexpected departure of the employee who had access to confidential and trade secret information. So we hope you found that this worst practices video was helpful to learn certain concepts. At this point, I'd like to turn it over to my partner, Michael Wexler, to get in some best practices in handling interviews with new employees, as well as how to handle the exit interview process.
Thanks, Robert. So now we're going to try and talk about some of the things that that certainly you tuned into this webinar for, is to learn about things that would be good practices that can help your businesses and help, as Robert said, create a culture of confidentiality. So one of those things is when we talk about the interviewing process, we try to encourage people to talk about general skills and talents, not to focus in on specific confidential information, trade secrets, customer information, margins, pricing, how a business is doing. All those things are pieces of information that someone may learn during the interviewing process inadvertently. They're also pieces of information that you may learn by simply working in the industry, but it's not something that we encourage people to specifically target during an interview because there can be a great pitfall to getting confidential information about an applicant's current employer. So one of the ways you try to do that also is by controlling the interview. Some interviewees, some applicants feel that the only way they're going to get the job is if they bring something to the table beyond their general skills and knowledge, beyond their experience, beyond their education, beyond their industry knowledge. Some people feel when they go to an interview, this is the opportunity to impress a new employer with all kinds of good information that applicant can bring to the table, and they will tend to go into areas that may not be permissible. And so one way to control that is to control the interview. If you put a potential hire at ease, if you control the interview with careful interview questions, and be prepared to stop an applicant when an applicant goes into areas that are areas that, yeah, you'd probably love to know about your competitor, but realistically, the cost is not worth the benefit. So you want to make clear to the applicant that under any circumstances, during the interview, and certainly if you hire the person, they are not to bring with them information from their former employer. They are not to solicit their colleagues to come with them. They are not to alert their customers that they're considering leaving or that they are leaving. Those are items which can be carefully controlled with best practices and in a way that doesn't expose an employer to liability because they're interviewing someone or bringing a new employee on board. One of the things we encourage is to focus on making a transition smooth. And by making a transition smooth, you talk to the employee, the potential hire, the new employee. You talk to the employee, and you talk about these issues, about what they can and can't bring with them. You talk about how they should work with their new employer to leave. Sure, 2 weeks' notice, there's a legal requirement to give 2 weeks' notice. That's just sort of an industry standard or just a polite standard that professional people will do. But your current employer may walk you out the door instantly. So when you talk about the transition, you want to talk about those issues. How is a person to resign? One key way to control the resignation is to have a written resignation and to have that written resignation prepared by the employee and reviewed by the new employer prior to actually turning it into the former employer. That way you can control it. And you can say, for example, I'm leaving, I'm going to X company, thank you for for the wonderful years here, I'm returning, and you can give a list in that resignation letter. I'm returning X binders, X computer disks. I've deleted everything belonging to my employer from my work computer, from my home computer. If you have a home computer that you use for work, you may want to delete all the information from your prior employer. But then you talk to this applicant about, well, there's going to be personal information out there. How do they retain that? And so you know, you tell that employee, well, you can take that information, you can download it to disk, but in your resignation letter, you give a list. Again, I'm leaving, I'm going to X, I'm going to X company, I've returned XYZ, I've downloaded from my home computer these items, I'm returning my company-owned computer, I deleted from there the kids' soccer schedule, pictures of the kids, and my personal financial information. And what you're doing by controlling the process is to control potentials for liability and controlling the employee's actions so that they don't expose the company or themselves to liability. One of the key things during the interview is to also check if the employee has any existing agreements. Now, there are several schools of thought on this, and we'll talk a little bit about that, but the bottom line is the best practice is to find out if a potential hire has an existing agreement with their employer so that the new employer can potentially mold the new position in a way that doesn't violate an agreement, or you know if a person you know, doesn't have any non-compete restrictions, or they don't have a non-solicit of employees or non-solicit of customer restrictions. So you want to know those things going into hiring a person, so you know how to you know whether the person is going to be a potential hire, and you know how that person is going to potentially be able to work within those constraints if you do hire the person. Why do we say it's good to know? Well, for example, in California, in the Salguero versus Creekguard case, that case highlights the fact that in California you have a 16,600 statute which prohibits non-compete agreements except for sales of business, but prohibits non-compete agreements for employees vis-a-vis in an employee relationship. And so the question becomes, if you don't know someone has an agreement and you hire someone in California and they have a non-compete, and then later you find out they do have a non-compete, what happens? Well, this case exemplifies the fact that if you find out someone has a non-compete in California, and even though they're illegal in California, but an employer decides, you know, I'm just going to terminate this person, you know, I'm going to follow the restrictions that this person has from an agreement that might be illegal in California, that potential employer, the new employer, could subject themselves to liability in one of two ways. One way is the former employer could bring a lawsuit potentially depending on the restrictions and depending on geographics and a number of issues, but the new employer could potentially be subject to litigation with the former employer because of an agreement that the new employer didn't even know about. Or two, if you know about the agreement and you acquiesce and you follow the agreement in California where these agreements are illegal generally, then you potentially could be held liable to from the new employee. Litigation could be brought by the new employee because it terminated the new employee when the 16,600 statutes say that non-compete between the employee and the employer are illegal, unless, of course, it's in the context of the sale of a business. So you want to make sure you know up front if a person has an agreement or not, because that will dictate how you treat that person's potential hire. The next thing we're going to turn to is, I just moved the slide here for you. Everything we just talked about is on the slide, and if you want to get a copy of this information, you can certainly contact us. But now we're going to turn to assessing restrictive covenants, and are the agreements enforceable? And that depends on what state you're in. That's the bottom line. There are a few states, California, North Dakota, where non-compete agreements are illegal. There are other states that take a very restrictive view of non-compete, such as Louisiana, where you have to have very specific items in your non-compete, such as in Louisiana parishes. You can't have a choice of law that's outside of Louisiana. You can't have a form selection clause that's outside of Louisiana. There are other restrictions. You know, for example, Wisconsin, if you have non-compete agreement and it's evaluated by a court and the court finds one thing wrong, then the entire agreement can go out the window. That used to be the law in Georgia, but that has recently changed within the last year or so, with the enactment of a new non-compete statute in Georgia. So one thing you have to look at is an agreement enforceable or not? And again, that depends on state law. And then the question becomes, when you're assessing the agreement, looking at this new employee, can you hire this employee and place them in a position where they won't violate their agreement? So where an agreement specifically says you can't work in your old territory, then the question is, can you hire this person and put them in a different territory? Or did this person sign the agreement mid-employment and get no consideration for it? Consequently, the agreement may not be enforceable. And so then you have to decide, is the agreement enforceable? Is it not enforceable? Do you take the risk regarding the consideration, or do you take the person and put them in a different territory? Or can you even hire this person at all? Maybe this person is a high-level employee, you know, let's say in the executive suite, and the agreement says it can't work for any competitor in the United States. You need to assess that and figure out, is that illegal? Is it legal? Can you abide by the agreement in some form or another? Do you want to take the legal risk of hiring this person with an agreement that has that kind of restriction? Again, all that comes down to is assessing the risk and assessing whether or not that employee will have value to the company. You know, one of the things that you look at when you evaluate agreements is you do some homework on whether or not the competitor regularly enforces agreements. Are they litigious or not? Are they a competitor that you can call up and work something out with, something that makes sense, that the former employer will feel at ease because your agreement is being followed to a degree, or whether your arch rivals and nothing will ever be worked on and you know you're going to have litigation if you hire an employee from a competitor with a covenant. Again, you need to decide the worth of the employee, the value, and the cost versus the benefit if you were to get in litigation. So one thing to consider potentially, and this is especially true in California, is if you hire an employee, let's say from out of state, you know, let's say from the East Coast, and you bring them to the West Coast to California, and that person has a non-compete agreement, and they move to California, take up residency there, and then the question becomes, that person may have a non-compete, but it'll be illegal in California, so you may need to decide whether or not to bring a declaratory judgment action in California to possibly invalidate the agreement from the East Coast that this employee brought with them. Again, no matter what the circumstances are, you still need to have that employee follow certain basics, which is to return information that belongs to the former employer and to make sure that the potential hire, the new hire, doesn't use information, trade secrets, confidential information from their old employer. And you also need to be prepared to talk to and communicate with the former employer, because many times that communication can get rid of problems in the future. When we talk about hiring a new employee, as Robert mentioned earlier, we want to create a culture of confidentiality. And in order to create that culture, we need employees to understand what confidentiality means and what information the company considers to be confidential. So in order to do that, one of the things that we recommend is that employers strongly consider a training program during the hiring process on the importance of protecting company information. Now, certainly information about confidentiality should be in a handbook. It can and should be in a separate standalone agreement that an employee signs when they join your organization. And again, there may be actual live hands-on training that goes along with that. We would also emphasize, as we said, the use of non-disclosure and trade secret protection agreements that people sign. And another good practice is to take those agreements and to remind people on a maybe semi-annual or certainly annual basis that they have those agreements. And it may take the form of a memo, it may take the form of an email, it may take the form of circulating the general policy or the handbook on a semi-annual or annual basis to remind people that they have confidentiality obligations and to emphasize this to create this culture of confidentiality. Having training once when a person starts, that's good, but having routine reminders is even better. And in the Seventh Circuit, Judge Posner once said, the more efforts an employer takes to protect confidential information, the more they demonstrate that that information has value. And if you actually got in a lawsuit over confidential or trade secret information, one of the items of proof, of course, is showing that you took reasonable measures to protect the secrecy of the information. And so how you bring an employee on and how you train them and what you have them sign are all pieces of information to demonstrate that confidentiality is important and it's being followed. One thing to certainly be aware of is the doctrine of inevitable disclosure. The thumbnail sketch of that is this. comes from a case, PepsiCo versus Redmond. Redmond worked for PepsiCo. He worked as the director of marketing for non-carbonated beverages. He decided to take a position with a competitor, I believe it was Quaker, with their non-carbonated beverages in the exact same role. Pepsi went to get an injunction to enjoin him, saying that he wasn't exactly candid about the responsibilities he would have in the new position, and the district court enjoined Redmond from taking on the director of marketing role at the competitor, at Quaker, because of this doctrine of inevitable disclosure that he engaged in conduct, and we like to call it duplicitous conduct, but conduct that made Pepsi uncomfortable, made the court uncomfortable, that he would that he could not go into the new position and do anything but use or be put in a position where he would inevitably use confidential information from his prior employer. And so he was enjoined for a while from holding that position. So that concept is certainly a concept that is valid in a number of states around the country and is a concept that an employer, a former employer, may use to try to enjoin a new an employee who left from working at a new employer. And the typical situation where that would come into play is generally where someone has taken information, they've gone to a new employer, they've downloaded information, they lied about where they were going, they lied about the responsibilities, they engaged in that duplicitous conduct, and so the doctrine of inevitable disclosure will come up and may potentially take what you thought was a really good hire and put that person on the bench through an injunction that the former employer gets against that employee. When you have highly sensitive hires, and maybe it's a high-level executive or maybe it's a person that a competitor values greatly, you know, a top salesperson, you want to make sure that that person is honoring their restrictive covenants. When we talk about restrictive covenants, you know, there are several elements to restrictive covenants, and we'll cover just a few of those items here. Certainly one agreement is a non-disclosure trade secret protection agreement. Essentially, it's an agreement that says that you will keep confidential information and trade secret information confidential. That agreement will also have in it certainly intellectual property assignment, and we'll get to that in a minute, but it also talks about a typical agreement will have in it you know, information that's not public, that's confidential, that the person learns on their job, needs to be kept confidential, and if information makes it into the public domain, then that's not information that the person needs to keep confidential. Another type of agreement is non-solicitation of employee agreements. It's exactly what it says. You know, there are agreements where you say, it says you will not solicit employees from your prior employer. Now, that will differ by state. Some states you can use a non-solicit. Some states you can use a non-hire provision. Some states you can't. And a non-solicit means you can't ask the person to come and work for you. Non-hire means you can't actually hire the person. And some states, like California, for example, you can't have a non-hire in California, but you can use a non-solicit to protect your workforce from raiding and that sort of thing. You can have agreements that relate to former employers' trade secrets, and those agreements will specify how the trade secrets of a former employer are to be dealt with, that the person understands that the new employer doesn't want that information, doesn't want to use it, so don't reveal it, don't keep it, don't use it at the new employer. Other agreements are computer use and access agreements, and they will specify, and they're also called IT agreements, they will specify exactly how intellectual property or information that's kept electronically are to be dealt with, who owns it, how it should be used, whether you know, software, private software can be used on company computer systems, and those sorts of policies. Also, social media policies are becoming the norm. And there's all kinds of case law and all kinds of statutes regarding social media and whether an employee needs to turn over passcodes and information to social media, to their employers, whether employers can look at social media and go into their accounts. You know, that differs by state. We could have an entire webinar on that topic because it's a very hot topic right now. But point is, you need to be aware in your jurisdiction what the law has to say about social media and what employers' rights are with regard to getting access to that social media, and what type of policies you as an employer want to use in social media, and what you, you know, how you want your employees to act using that. And then again, invention assignment agreements, and those are important because if employees work on research and development, if they work on ideas and concepts, employers want to make sure that agreements are signed by a new employee so that anything that employee works on belongs to the new employer, and you don't have a work-for-hire issue and essentially a dispute over who owns intellectual property that's created by an employee. One of the things that we also like to see in agreements is a term of the agreement that specifically says that the employees, that the new employee is representing, that they don't have any trade secrets or confidential information of their prior employer in their possession. So in the hiring, in the hiring mechanism, you want to make sure that employees aren't bringing things over, but you also want them to certify that in their agreements that they sign with the new employer. You want the new employee to represent in writing that they don't have any property belonging to their new employer. I'm sorry, to their prior employer. And what I mean by that is, they need to return everything: binders, thumb drives, information that's kept on a home computer, anything that they may still have from the former employer. Want to make sure that they represent that they've been returned it. You also want the employee to represent in writing that the employee will abide by any agreements from their prior employer. And that goes along with finding out if they have any prior agreements, so you know how to deal with those, and that the person will abide by them. What you don't want to do is hire someone, and then they subject the company to liability because they've kept information, they've hidden things, they've copied things, they've brought information into your shop, and essentially brought a problem to your doorstep. And then, of course, you want to make sure that the new employer has the ability to terminate someone and potentially get damages if a hire falsely represents that they had prior agreements and those sorts of things. You also want to consider with the new employee whether you will indemnify them in some fashion. If you have a person you're going to hire and they're very valuable and there's some issue about an agreement that they have, that person may ask for indemnification or cost of defense. Two different concepts. Indemnification would mean that a new employee would be indemnified, would have all costs paid for a defense if they were sued by their former employer, and if there's any judgment rendered against them. Cost of defense would be that the new employer would pay for a defense if they were sued by the former employer, but wouldn't be responsible for paying any kind of judgment that might be obtained against the former employee. Another thing, when we talk about invention assignment agreements, you want to be very careful in those agreements to say that you actually assign things. A classic mistake is someone says that you will assign something, you shall assign something. You want to specifically say that they are assigning, so that the actual assignment document that's signed really does assign something and doesn't simply say you'll do it at some time in the future. That can create an issue as to ownership of information when an employee works for you. You can look at that case, Board of Trustees of Leland and Lanford Junior University, if you want to look at a case that talks about that. But the short answer here is make sure you assign things. When we talk about all these things, we talk about continuum. And I'm hoping you can see the color chart on your screen. The red zone are things to be very cautious of. The yellow zone is to be semi-cautious of. And the green zone is items to include. And when you look at this, you'll see a lot of the things that we just discussed, that when you're talking about hiring new employees, everyone should include non-disclosures, everyone should have invention assignment, everyone should return a property, everyone should have an employee agree to have an exit interview, and you should conduct one, and that new employees should acknowledge their obligations to their former employer, and you should have a computer use and access policy. Depending on what state you're in, depending on what business you're in, depending on the risks you want to take, you might use caution for the yellow zone items, non-solicitation of employees and customers, notice provisions regarding termination, social media policies, ownership agreements, choice of law and forum selection, arbitration, differs by state. In California, for example, non-solicitation of employees is okay, but non-hire isn't. Social media policy differs by state and whether employers can look at social media that an employee has. Choice of law may be illegal and improper, such as in Louisiana. And then arbitration, whether you can have an arbitration and how that benefits you will differ by state. You'd certainly want to talk to your legal professional about that as an employer to decide what's best for your organization. And then, of course, the red zone are things that you need to use extreme caution with. And, for example, if you have a non-compete that has a forfeiture clause, and what we're talking about there is a non-compete says you can't work for someone, or you can't work with particular customers, And if you violate, you forfeit certain severance benefits or certain dollars that you may have gotten as part of leaving or as part of a termination. There's all kinds of issues with that as to whether or not it's legal, but then, of course, whether it works for your organization. So, for example, the $10 million salesperson leaves, and they have a non-compete agreement. It says if you violate, then the person forfeits certain equity that they may have had vested over time. You may have a problem then getting an injunction to stop that person's activities. And let's say that person had $200,000 in equity versus a $10 million salesperson, you'd probably want to be able to get injunctive relief against that person, whereas the $200,000 in equity certainly by comparison wouldn't be driving your decision necessarily. The sales would be. So you want to be very careful with using forfeiture provisions. And then guardian leave, of course, is where you pay someone to stay on the sidelines, and you need to look state by state whether that's appropriate, and then certainly whether the cost it benefits your organization, and whether or not you could get stung where you pay a person to stay on the sidelines, but then an agreement is found to be unenforceable, and potentially you may still have to pay the person. We talked about exit interviews. Exit interviews are very important, and a few pointers on exit interviews. You want to prepare for the interview. If you're going to conduct an exit interview, you want to actually know what you're talking about. You want to understand the information that the person had access to, the records they had access to, and have that exit interview done by in-house counsel or HR person with the employee's manager present so that you can get in detail around whether the person had access to information, returned the information, and what they actually returned. Simply saying, did you return all your information? Yeah, from some HR person who has no idea what the person is actually doing at the employer is not very useful. If the manager is there, the manager can add some detail to that. If someone has prepared for the interview, then they know that this person had access to pricing, margins, the latest research and development. They'll be able to then focus the interview, and preparation is key then. You want to question the departing employee in detail, not just simply give broad questions. Did you return everything? Did you return your computer? You want to get into detail. Well, did you return your computer? Did you back it up at home? Did you download anything? Do you have any thumb drives or other media in which you took information off the computer? You want to go through detail on those sorts of things, not ask just broad questions. You want to find out why the person is leaving, because that may not mesh later with the facts that you find out if you have to enforce your agreement, that in fact maybe they were targeted by a recruiter to leave, but they tell you a story, oh, well, you know, my grandmother in the middle of Nowhereville is very sick and ill, and I'm moving to Nowhereville to help her and to tend to the crops. Well, you find out later that they were targeted by your competitor and they're getting a nice vice president position. That information during the exit interview shows that the person can't be trusted, and that will be helpful in court if you need to enforce an agreement. You want to ask an employee what new position they're going to have at a competitor. Very useful, again, if they don't tell you the truth. And it's very useful for the inevitable disclosure doctrine if they lie to you about the position to hide what they're really doing. You want to check an employee's computer activities and work activities in advance of the meeting. You want to find out, did the person download anything, send an email home, and then ask the person about that. One thing we highly recommend is that when an employee is leaving, grab up their computer, grab up their hard drive, and do an examination. But even if you don't do an examination, grab up their hard drive, lock it up, keep a chain of custody so that if you need it later, you have that hard drive available. Hard drives are very inexpensive, so to put it on a shelf and keep it there for 6 months to a year can be very helpful to you if you need information later about an employee's activities. But again, try to check activities before your interview so you can ask, why did you come in at 3 a.m. and bundle up a whole bunch of information and download it into a zip file and send it out by email 2 days before you resigned? If you have that information ahead of time, it can make your exit interview very productive. You want to make sure, obviously, that everything's been returned, including email, including things that are kept in various electronic storage devices, as well as iCloud, cloud data, cloud computing, and whether that information is being kept in any social media accounts or personal email accounts. And ask for an inventory, potentially, of everything that the person is returning. You want to make sure that if the person has any devices that are owned by them, that any company information is deleted from those devices. So if they have a telephone that they personally own, but they have all kinds of company information on it or information about company customers, you want to make sure that that information gets deleted. That can all be resolved, of course, if the company owns a telephone rather than the individual owns a telephone. then there's no issue as to who owns the device, and you get the device back upon a departing employee's resignation. When you have the exit interview, you want to make sure that the behind-the-scenes processes are going on, which means that the person's access to company computer networks is disabled. You want to obtain all the passwords and usernames for various email and accounts that the person may have been using for work so that you can check those items. Again, subject to local state law with regard to use of social media and what access an employer can have. You want to inform the employer of the continuing obligations. I like to have employees sign an acknowledgement that they acknowledge that they have a confidentiality agreement. They acknowledge that they have a non-solicitation agreement so that they follow those items. You might consider, using a letter to the new employer to advise the new employer and to the employee, advising them of their continuing obligations. For example, the classic situation is the departing employee doesn't tell the new employer that they have an agreement, and then the former employer sends a letter, and now the new employer finds out that the guy had an agreement or the gal had a confidentiality agreement or some other type of agreement, and then they think twice about the hire. Now, there's certain risk with that, and potentially if a new employer decides to terminate an offer because they were advised that the person had an agreement by the former employer and the actual departing employee didn't bring up on their own, there could be a tortious interference claim against the new employer. So you have to, against a former employer by sending a letter. You need to be very careful about that. But certainly a letter to the employee reminding them of their obligations is key. And like I said, an acknowledgement at the exit interview acknowledging that they have these ongoing obligations is also very helpful in protecting the former employer's rights. We spoke about it a moment ago briefly, but preserve emails and electronic devices so they can be forensically reviewed if you need to, in order to determine whether this employee did something improper, and again, use an exit interview certification that I just mentioned. We're now going to see a video for a couple minutes here that will demonstrate some of the better practices that can be used certainly with employees leaving, and then we'll discuss some of that in just a moment.
Good morning, Toby.
Good morning.
Well, Toby, I have to say, looking at your resume, I think you'd be a perfect fit for our company.
Your background experience is spot on, your recommendations are glowing, but I want to hear from you. What do you think that you'll be an asset to our company?
Where do I begin? First of all, I have extensive contacts and great relationships with customers all across Southern California. I'd, of course, let them know that I'm changing jobs, and I'm sure they would follow me anywhere.
That's impressive, but be careful with those customer contacts. I mean, we want you for your general experience in the sales industry and your high standards of customer service, not because you worked with customer A or customer B.
No, that makes sense. You know that accounting firm on First Street, the one with the green and white building?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think I had my taxes done there last year.
Well, let me tell you how much they've been paying for software the last year.
Again, Toby, be careful. We don't want that kind of specific information. In fact, HR would have my head if they knew we were even talking about this.
Oh, okay. I wouldn't want to get you in trouble.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's understandable. You're proud of your achievements, and specific examples are a great way to show it. But let's take this conversation in a different direction. Why don't you give me some general examples of what you think your best managerial skills are?
I would say that I think conflict resolution is probably one of my best skills. For the past 5 years, I've managed a group of 10 district sales reps and 2 regional sales managers. We get along great now, but things were very strained at the beginning. I replaced an old regional manager who got fired, but there was a big group of district reps who didn't think that he deserved to get fired. So I inherited this group. At first, they were not willing to work with me, but slowly, I gained their trust, and just last year, my team was the most profitable one in Southern California. So we've come a long way, and I credit a lot of that to my ability to foster trust and teamwork.
Great, Toby. I mean, as a new company ourselves, we've had a lot of trouble getting teams to work well together. Your leadership skills would be a real asset during the startup period.
And that's exactly why I thought to apply here in the first place. I want to get in on these team-building projects right from the beginning. But you want to know something that's really ironic, actually? One of the last big projects I worked on was an analysis of how to slow your expansion in Southern California.
I'm sorry about that.
Well, I mean, no need to be sorry. Look, I get it. Your loyalties lie with wherever you're working at the time. But we do have to be really careful with this, Toby. You were probably exposed to confidential information while you were working on that, and you might use it in your job here. Would you mind if we changed around your job responsibilities for the first year or so to make sure that you're not using your previous employer's confidential information?
Well, you know, I mean, ideally I would prefer to take on all of my full responsibilities from day one and work with the same customers, but if that's the way it has to be, then so be it, yeah.
Okay, no, I mean, thanks for your flexibility. You really do sound perfect for this position. When could you start?
Well, as soon as you want me. The less notice I give, the less I have to deal with all those awkward goodbyes.
Really? I was thinking about more of, I don't know, like a 2-week time frame. Don't you want to take some time to transition out of your old job?
That's a good point. Let me check with my boss and I'll get back to you on that one.
Because we're in the sales industry, HR did tell me that I have to ask if you signed any agreements with your previous employer. Do you happen to sign one?
I don't know. I think I could have signed one of those, you know, keep things confidential and don't misuse our computer network agreements, but I don't even really remember what it said. It's probably no big deal. I hear the courts barely enforce those things anyway, so I think it's best if we just not worry about it.
Well, I mean, not exactly. Those things can be a serious headache later down the road. Why don't you see if you can go ahead and get a copy from HR of anything you might have signed and send it my way. In fact, I also need to tell you that our offer is contingent upon our review of any previous agreements you've signed.
I could probably dig one up or get an extra copy from HR. I'll email it to you later today. By the way, are you guys looking to fill any positions in your new office? Because I have lots of coworkers who I think would be like a really great fit here. They've been complaining a lot about how management is really going south lately, and I recently worked with a big team in putting together an RFP for a franchisor that's looking to expand in Orange County. So, I mean, we're so far along in that proposal that I would hate to leave the whole team behind.
Yeah, no, I mean, thanks for the offer, Toby, but we do all of our hiring through an outside recruiting agency or through job postings on our website. Recruiting your coworkers to come with you, it's a surefire way to make your previous employer angry, and it also might violate obligations that you have.
Yeah. That makes sense. Anyway, I'll email you the agreement and we'll get a start date finalized. I have to say, it is nice to see that you're interested in my talents and skills as opposed to just with the customers that I've worked with.
Sounds good. Thanks for your time, Toby. Your experience is really going to be an asset here. Obviously, we need to look at those agreements, but hopefully everything will work out and we'll be able to extend you an offer soon. As a reminder, don't bring any of your former employer's information or documents with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we want you to leave with a clean slate and return everything.
Hi.
Hi, come in.
Good to see you. How are you?
Hi, Toby. Thank you for taking the time to meet with me today for your exit interview.
Sure thing.
I would like to thank you for staying an extra 2 weeks to help transition the customer accounts.
Happy to do it. I didn't want to leave on a bad note, and you do have my final paycheck after all, so I didn't want to miss out on that.
Right. I have your final paycheck. Aside from your check, our first order of business is to make sure that you return all company property. I will need to collect all your company Blackberries, laptops, thumb drives, etc. I've also got a checklist of what we've given you over the years, so let me take a look to see what you brought today and make sure it's all accounted for.
Sure thing. Here are the hard copy documents that I have.
Okay.
Most of the electronics that I've been using are my own. No offense, but the technology here has come from the Stone Age. I returned my 2008 Blackberry the day that IT gave it to me. I've been using my own personal iPhone ever since. IT got me access to the network, it seemed.
Your personnel file does indicate that you returned the BlackBerry quite some time ago. However, I also see that you were provided a laptop and several company USB devices. I see the laptop, but not the USB devices. I will need you to return those as well.
Mm-hmm. I will do that. I left those in my desk, I believe. I will bring them to you right after we're done here.
Great. Also, with respect to your iPhone, I'm going to make sure that IT disables your network access according to our BYOD policy.
Sounds good.
Also, IT ran a report indicating that you had emailed some company documents from your work email to your personal email a few days ago.
Mm-hmm. Yep, some of my Outlook connections.
Okay, well, we're going to need to make sure that those emails, as well as any other company documents, are deleted in your personal email account. I'm going to ask that you make arrangements with me and IT to have those removed.
Okay, no problem.
I also noted that you were working on the franchisor proposal for their Orange County expansion with other members of the team. Have you returned all documents related to that proposal? The reason I asked is that there were no hard copies in your office.
Oh, well, yeah, I guess, good point. I think I still do have a copy at home now that you mention it. I'll make sure to get that to you.
Also, I know that you do a lot of work from home. Did you store any company data on your computer at home?
Yeah, actually I did.
Okay, I'm going to ask that you work with me, that you work with me and the IT department to arrange to have material removed from your computer.
Yeah, sure, not a problem.
Is there any other company property that needs to be returned?
I think that pretty much covers it.
Were you in charge of updating the new company Twitter account?
Yeah, I was. What should we do about that? It sort of transformed into my own personal Twitter account at some point.
Well, you do remember that we asked you to sign an agreement indicating that the account was the company account, right?
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, I would say that it is your account. My name isn't even on it. I mean, sure, I posted a few tweets that were directed at my friend group, but, you know, I doubt I'll keep using it after that.
Well, great. Then in that case, can you write down the password? Hopefully we'll find someone else to maintain it now.
Well, we hope you enjoyed the video, and the video highlights for you some of the things that we've been discussing, such as interviewing the employees' coworkers and examining email activity and conducting forensic reviews, all the sorts of things. You know, there are plenty of employees who leave and do the honorable thing. They resign, they return everything, everything's on the up and up. But there are folks who don't do things properly, and that's why a post-termination investigation is key. And so you want to, in that investigation, go to the sources of information and find out what the person was doing, and you can find that out from the coworkers, from email activity, by conducting forensic reviews. You can look at badge records and access logs and see if an employee is coming in at 2, 3, 4 in the morning. Can't tell you how many lawsuits that we've brought against former employees where we find out they went in at 3 a.m., and then we find out they were downloading and copying information. That's a dead giveaway. No employee should be coming in at 3 a.m. right before they leave. You want to look at phone records, potentially, see who people have been calling. You want to see, you know, what's going on in the marketplace and what your employees, your sales force, for example, are hearing in the marketplace about the employee and leaving. And look at social media accounts. And what I'm talking about there is, you know, look at LinkedIn. Look at Facebook. Look at, I don't know if, MySpace and all these things are still popular, but certainly Facebook and LinkedIn are great ways to get information. You'd be surprised what people put on there. They'll put on there a week before they leave. They'll put their new employer on their social account. They'll put information about where they can be contacted. They said they were going to live with Grandma in Nowhereville, and you find out that they're taking a job from their LinkedIn page with your arch rival who's a block away. So social media can be very helpful. So you've been listening to this presentation for a while, and so one of the things that we want to do is give you the CLE code so that you can get CLE credit for this wonderful presentation. So to receive CLE credit for this webinar, please write down the following code on the CLE attendance affirmation form found on the last page of your presentation materials, and then submit the form to the person indicated on that page. The code is is SS0513. The CLE code is SS0513. Now we'll turn the presentation over to Robert, who will talk about some of the hot topics in trade secret and employment law.
Thanks, Michael. We wanted to highlight at this point some hot topics in this general topic of recruiting and departing employee issues. And we've isolated three real hot topics that we've been seeing in our practice recently. First are strategies to work around limitations on non-compete agreements in various jurisdictions, as well as ways to enhance your ability to get post-termination restrictions on departing employees. And we're also going to cover another hot topic, which is BYOD policies. And essentially what that is they bring your own device policy. A lot of corporate clients are employing those type of policies because they're finding benefits in allowing employees to use their own electronic devices, be it an iPhone, iPad. So they have their own devices, and then the employer needs to have policies as far as, well, who owns the particular data on that policy and what happens if you leave. So Josh is going to get into a little bit about the BYOD policies. And then finally, Josh is going to cover some hot topics in social media as far as social media ownership and social media policies, the best practices in those areas. And these three topics we think are very important when evaluating the various recruiting and departing employee issues that are the subject of our webinar. Now, with respect to non-competition agreements, what type of workaround strategies are there out there? Now, generally, you know, in a lot of jurisdictions, non-compete agreements are enforceable. You know, they typically apply the rule of reason. And so we're not really talking about that particular issue. Obviously, they need to be narrowly tailored and reasonable in geographic time limitation and scope. But what about those jurisdictions that are troublesome jurisdictions where you may not be able to enforce the full scope of a non-compete that you would like to? Well, obviously, there's a lot of exceptions, and it may not apply to every situation, but you may find some of these suggestions helpful for your particular company. Obviously, most jurisdictions allow non-competes in the sale of a business, a partnership, a corporation, or LLC. So if you have a high-level person that's selling their business and you want to bind them to a non-compete, that's a workaround strategy if a particular jurisdiction has a strong public policy against non-competes. The other thing is to use narrowly tailored non-solicitive customer and employee provisions and non-accept business clauses. So if you have a particular jurisdiction where non-competes are typically ruled unenforceable or the courts strictly scrutinize them, which in a lot of jurisdictions they do strictly scrutinize them, consider instead of using a non-compete, a more narrowly tailored customer or an employee provision, whether that's a non-solicit or a non-accept business clause. Another strategy that some employers use are having forum selection and choice of law provisions for their home forum. And if their particular home forum is a pro-non-compete jurisdiction, what they'll consider doing is having all their employees nationwide, they may have a few exceptions for California or Louisiana, but have a standard forum where disputes are heard and the home forum, the law will be of their home forum. And a recent example of that is in the Northern District of California, a particular Pennsylvania employer had asked their employees to sign non-competes, and the California employee challenged the non-compete agreement in California. And what the federal court in California did is somewhat surprising. The federal court ended up dismissing the employee's lawsuit and said, you have a binding forum selection provision. Any disputes arising out of this particular non-compete agreement need to be determined in Pennsylvania. So you can sort of see the writings on the wall with respect to that particular employee. If the employer goes to Pennsylvania to enforce the non-compete, it will likely be enforceable. This is an example of one of the workaround strategies that we're seeing. Another particular workaround strategy is the notice provision. And there's two components to the notice provision. First, as part of a trade secret protection agreement, you can ask the employee to notify you of where they're going, when they leave, and what they're going to be doing, and you can have a particular provision for a couple of years, and you're providing information so you can gauge the risk to your particular confidential trade secret information or whether it'll be a particular violation of the non-compete. The other concept of a notice provision is that before the employee leaves, that they actually have to provide you a certain amount of notice period, be it 6 months, 3 months, a month, 2 weeks. And that's a particular provision that doesn't work in all jurisdictions, but that in some jurisdictions they have found those enforceable. You always have an issue with respect to damages, but it's something that you may want to include in your agreement so that you can get the heads up if an employee is leaving. Another concept we've talked about a little bit is garden leave, essentially that the employee stays on the sideline after they leave for a certain period of time and is provided compensation for that time period and obviously is not working for a competitor during that period. Another similar type concept is a consultant arrangement where the employee leaves as an active employee but turns into a sort of a consultant in a more narrow and circumscribed role. They could take on less duties or no duties at all, and the trick there is making it appear enforceable so that it doesn't look just like a garden leave or a non-compete agreement where the employee is not doing anything. Typically, employers also try to use non-competes and severance agreements, and we also see either in the original non-compete or in the severance agreement liquidated damages if they violate them. Now, if you use liquidated damages, you run up against the issue that you may not be entitled to injunctive relief, so use those with caution. And then also there's retention agreements similar to the whole consultant arrangement concept, but particularly retention agreements are also used when you feel that particular employees have been compromised, that there's an active recruiting campaign going on by a competitor to poach your employees, and you may want to employ retention agreements to get to sort of buy their loyalty and give you some assurances. Another workaround in the non-compete area is equity and stock option agreements. You have an argument there that ERISA federal law applies and that the non-compete agreement is not challengeable under a state law where the state law, say it's California, may prohibit non-compete agreements. There's at least an argument that if you include a non-compete agreement in an equity stock option agreement covered by ERISA, that you may be able to get in some type of restrictive covenant, be it a limited non-compete or at least some customer restriction provisions. Now, again, this is always subject to challenge, and if you had a California state court ruling on the issue, you may be in a much different position if you had a federal court in your home forum ruling on the issue, again, highlighting the importance of a forum selection provision. And then I think in a nutshell, the last two points in our slide here kind of highlight what the whole point of this presentation is that apart from the non-compete strategy, an aggressive enforcement of your trade secret protections and having trade secret protection agreements is essential and can be a workaround if you're in a jurisdiction that prohibits non-competes. And what we mean by that is that a company needs to protect their trade secrets, needs to have appropriate interviewing processes and exit interviewing processes, and if employed correctly, can put the employer in a much better position if they get an employee that goes to a direct competitor. Now, one of the hot theories is this theory called the threatened misappropriation theory. And under the Uniform Trade Secret Act, which is adopted in over 46 states, you can get an injunction not just for actual misappropriation of trade secrets, but also the threatened misappropriation of trade secrets. And that can be a very useful vehicle for employers that feel aggrieved by a lot of employees leaving or a particular employee leaving and wanting to do something about it. And apart from taking into account restrictive covenants, non-compete agreements, the threatened misappropriation trade secret theory can provide you with a tremendous amount of benefits. Now, one particular case that has come out in the last couple of years that has articulated what the threatened misappropriation theory is and just demonstrated that it's different from the inevitable disclosure doctrine is the Central Valley General Hospital case. And in that particular case, what the defendant argued is that there really can't be an injunction for threatened misappropriation, that threatened misappropriation and inevitable disclosure, which California has rejected, are one and the same. And there the Court of Appeal disagreed and said that the principle of threatened misappropriation of trade secrets may be enjoined is the law of California, despite the rejection of the inevitable disclosure doctrine. So what does threatened misappropriation then mean? Well, at least in California, the Central Valley case laid out the particular factors. It's more than just the mere possession of the trade secret by a defendant who has obtained the trade secret by proper means. What you need to show is either prior improper use or disclosure of the trade secrets, or an intent to improperly use or disclose the trade secrets, or a refusal to return documents after a demand. So what does this mean in a nutshell? Well, I think it highlights the importance of the exit interview, because if you have a particular employee that is uncooperative or refuses to sit in an exit interview, you can help establish the intent to improperly use or disclose company trade secrets. Also, if they refuse to make their particular personal devices accessible to remove company materials, or they refuse to return computers or other type company documents as part of the exit interview process, you're going well down the line to start establishing your threatened misappropriation theory and going to the court and establishing that you've done everything you could do with this particular employee to get their cooperation, and they refuse to comply. Therefore, it's inappropriate to get an injunction on the basis of the threatened misappropriation theory. At this point, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Josh Salinas, who's going to get into a real hot topic, which is bring your own device policies, and he's also going to get into social media policies.
Thanks, Robert. We've seen BYOD policies become an emerging issue in regards to protecting trade secret and confidential information. We've seen a significant increase in employees who are now choosing to bring their own device and use their own personal device to access their company emails, company documents, and other company information. And kind of using these hybrid devices has great benefits for the company because, one, it reduced costs where the company no longer has to expend money and paying for these extra devices. And then also the employees generally have more familiarity and can be more productive using their own personal device. However, there are some inherent problems now with these hybrid devices because the employee now has their personal information really in a close proximity with company data. And so there are some significant concerns. One, in developing a policy, the company should specify which devices are actually going to be permitted. That way they can have, they can ensure that their infrastructure and their security policy can effectively manage whatever device the employee is bringing. Most importantly, the company should have a clear policy regarding the restrictions for the use and transfer of the company information and trade secrets, and also define the ownership of data on that device. I've spoken with individuals who've said that they've recently purchased a new iPad or a new smartphone, but all they do is check emails on that device. But it's still their device, and the information they believe is entirely theirs on their device. So there are some concerns because the employer wants to ensure that their company information is going to be properly protected and kept secure. Also, a big concern is you want to have the ability to remotely wipe the device in case the device is lost, if it's stolen. That way you can delete the information so nobody else who does find the device can access it. There are some concerns with personal data and privacy on the device because if the company is going to be remotely wiping that its information from the device, it may also be wiping the person's personal data. And so you want to put in your policy a clear explanation that in case the device is lost and has to be remotely wiped, if there is any investigations or incident responses, that there's a clear explanation of how personal data will be treated if there is a possibility that it could be wiped. And it gives the employee notice. That way they can ahead of time back up their device just in case. Finally, you want to have the policy and the procedures incorporated into your exit interview. Mike previously talked about that when the employee is checking out in their exit interview, they return their company phone or the company devices. But there is an issue when it's a personal device. And so what you want to make sure you do is still wipe the company data from the device and ensure that all company email or any access to company documents or the network is terminated and closed with the exit interview. The White House actually has provided a good overview of BYOD policies. There's a link we provided at the bottom of the slide. And there's some good key considerations for developing your BYOD policy, and there also is some case studies where different governmental agencies have employed their own BYOD policies. And then finally, there also are some good samples at that link if you wanted to develop your own policy and wanted to have a good start from that. Now, the next hot topic we've seen is in the area of social media. It's pretty undeniable that social media is really ubiquitous and pervasive in the business marketplace. The problem now with this heightened connectivity is that there's an inherent risk to valuable trade secrets and confidential data that can now be more easily disclosed or even accidentally disclosed. One of the problems is now many employees and individuals have seen social media as more of a personal communication mechanism, and so the ability to kind of distinguish between personal social media and business social media has been a growing concern. One of the concerns with security regarding the disclosure of trade secrets and confidential information is illustrated in this a shocking study by Bitdefender, which is a software security company. And in this case, Bitdefender had a control group of about 2,000 individuals. And what they did is they had an anonymous stranger individual solicit a friend request on a social media site. Now, albeit it was a very attractive individual who made this request, and therefore about 94% of the control group of those 2,000 individuals actually accepted this friend request. Now, while this may not seem, a great concern, the study further revealed that about 20 of those individuals actually engaged in a conversation with this stranger, and kind of great concern is actually that 15 of those individuals actually began divulging secret and confidential information regarding their company's internal business strategies or other unreleased products and company information. So it kind of illustrates the growing concern that social media now can actually have inherent risks of accidentally disclosing valuable company information. Now, there are several best practices when a company is employing their social media policy. Most importantly, you want to have a separate social media policy, not merely incorporated into a non-disclosure agreement, but actually have a completely separate policy that clearly defines and explains various restrictions. You want to have, in particular, prohibition on the disclosure of trade secret and confidential information by the employees. Now, the concern is when you have a trade secret policy or a social media policy, it can't be too overly broad. In fact, the National Labor Relations Board has been cracking down and been more active in the social media atmosphere and has been criticizing social media policies that have been too broad, specifically when they infringe on the Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act. And Section 7 protects employees the rights to engage in concerted activity and discuss the workplace. And so the National Labor Relations Board is making sure that these overbroad social media policies don't have a chilling effect that infringes on the employees' Section 7 rights. Now, there are several things you can do in the social media policy. Specifically, the National Labor Relations Board wants clear, specific examples of what the employee can't disclose in the social media account. In fact, earlier this year, the Acting General Counsel released a memorandum criticizing certain social media policies and actually explaining that they would be better if they actually had specific examples and also were well communicated to the employees to educate them of what information they cannot disclose. Now, you also want to have an agreement regarding the ownership of the social media account. The rising issue that we've seen is the case of the company has a summer intern or a lower-level employee, and the company tells the interns that they want to, create a social media account. And so the intern creates the account for the company, leaves the company, and the company later discovers that that intern still has access to the account, maybe has changed it or is still posting information, and the company, is trying to figure out, who actually owns the account. And we'll see actually in two case examples, the Eagle versus Morgan and the Phone Dog versus Kravitz case, the issues underlying the ownership of social media accounts. But as a practical consideration, you want to have a separate agreement clearly identifying that the company owns the social media account and the account was created for the company. You also, as a practical consideration, want to have the employee, when they create the account, give you a copy of the password so that way you can access it when they leave. and also as a fallback safe mechanism, have the employee create the account under a company email using the company's domain. That way, if the employee leaves and does change the password, when the company has to call the social media provider and recover the account, there is some credibility knowing, as the provider can see, that the account was created with the company's name. One of the first examples of good practices of social media ownership involves the Eagle versus Morgan case. It's a case that arose out of the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. And the underlying issue in that case was the ownership of a LinkedIn social media account. In that case, Dr. Linda Eagle created a LinkedIn account to promote her company and establish business and network connections. And actually, for a good measure, the company had a general policy that encouraged employees to create social media accounts and had the employees actually give the company a copy of the password to create the account, use the company email to create the account, and then finally the employee had to agree to return the account to the employer once they left. Now, the dispute arose when Dr. Eagle left the company. The company then logged into the LinkedIn account, changed the password, and then uploaded the new employee who would then take her place. And so the company was able to retain the account and also the network and business connections associated with it. Now, the problem Dr. Eagle was saying was that they had essentially hacked her account. It was her social media account and her network connections. And she brought several claims, including claims under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and for idea misappropriation and unfair competition. Now, the court dismissed the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act claim, finding that there were no damages for the loss of her business or network connections. But kind of most importantly, from a practical concern, this case illustrates the good procedure that the company had of having the employee create the account with the employer's email, and giving them a copy of the password that when the employee left, the company was able to retain access of it. Now, on the contrary, there's another case that's currently pending. It's in the Northern District of California, the PhoneDog versus Kravitz case. Now, this case involved the ownership of a Twitter account. PhoneDog is a site that does reviews for mobile devices, and a dispute arose when one of its employees left the company, and PhoneDog was saying that it was still used. The employee was using its Twitter account. It brought claims of conversion and trade secret misappropriation. Now, the employee, Noah Kravitz, in the case, contended that nobody asked him to create the social media account. He created the Twitter account on his own. They never asked for the password, and also that nobody asked him what to tweet. Everything was it was his account. One kind of nuanced, interesting fact was actually that the account he created on Twitter, the name, I believe, was PhoneDog Kravitz or PhoneDog Noah, and then when he changed it, he took out the company's name when he left the company. But the underlying fact was that the company said he had taken the Twitter account, the password it alleged was a trade secret, and also the followers in the account were a trade secret. Now, the court, on a motion to dismiss, allowed the trade secret and conversion claims to go forward, saying that there was still evidence outside of the pleadings that it needed to consider and could it dismiss it at that time. But it shows that the company did not have an effective policy in place where it didn't have an ownership agreement or didn't have the password, and therefore it wasn't able to retain it and still had to go to litigation to ultimately recover the account. Now, that case is set for trial. I believe it was postponed for this month, so we're still waiting for a resolution of that case. Now, finally, we just have a couple examples of social media ownership that has become an emerging issue in this area, specifically that Christow versus Beatport court found that trade secrets could be, or actually a MySpace account, the followers could be protectable as trade secrets, and also the loan companies versus Piggy Paint, which discussed the ownership, the business opportunities regarding Facebook fans of a Facebook website. Now, there's some other social media cases, and as Mike previously discussed, there has been new social media legislation, specifically California and Maryland, and Illinois have restrictions on when employees can demand information regarding their employees' social media names and passwords. Now, there are exceptions in those legislations, specifically California, which allows the investigations for improper workplace conduct, for example, trade secrets, misappropriation. But companies should still check with the applicable state to see what information they can get through their employee social media. Now I'll turn it over to Robert Milligan.
Thanks, Josh. Well, thank you for joining us for today's presentation. This is our 7th webinar of the year. We will be having our final webinar program of the year. It's going to be on hot topics in trade secret law in California in December. We did have a few questions. We're running a little bit short on time, so we'll cover some of those questions. If we don't get to your question, we will reach out to you and provide you an email response. The first question is, with respect to choice of law, I thought some jurisdictions don't honor your choice of law provisions in the non-compete context. I can handle that question. That's true. Some particular jurisdictions don't honor choice of law provisions in the non-compete context, California being one. Other states don't honor them as well. The key with respect to the choice of law provision is to couple the choice of law provision along with the forum selection provision. And you stand a much better chance of attempting to enforce the forum selection clause in your home forum if you do that. Now, that's not to say that in the employee's home forum that they won't challenge the choice of law provision, but as we discussed in the program, at least there's one case in California where the federal district court honored the out-of-state forum selection clause and effectively provided the Pennsylvania employer an ability to enforce a non-compete against the California employee. The next question, this one's for Mike. Are there any circumstances that it would be appropriate for a potential employer not to ask to see the prospective employee's restrictive covenant agreement?
No, not really. Some employers might think, if I don't know someone has an agreement, then I can't get found liable later for tortious interference because I didn't know the person had a contract when they came on board. I wouldn't advise against that. That policy is just going to leave you in a very awkward position when you find out if that someone you hired has an agreement later. Always better to find out ahead of time. I see another question here. I think, Robert, you'll probably answer this. Are there some latest technology innovations that can assist an employer in protecting their data from departing employees?
Absolutely. The use of technology to prohibit data theft or prevent data theft is essential for any company these days. There's software out there that will help restrict downloading of information onto USB devices. It will also detect and prohibit large email transfers, so the typical instance of an employee transferring a large amount of email or uploading email to an FPT site. There's also software that will help detect suspicious email. Some of it can be affordable. One of the key things that we're seeing in this area that employers need to take stock of is that it used to be hard copy data or hard copy documents being stolen, then it would be email to personal accounts and then email transferred onto thumb drives. And the latest device or area of choice that we're seeing a lot of theft of is employees putting information into the cloud, either in their LinkedIn account, in their Dropbox, in their Google Docs. That's the next real hot area that we're seeing where employees are stealing data and storing the data in those particular accounts. Looks like we have another question. This one's for Josh. Do you have any practical advice on how to craft a social media policy to address the National Labor Relations Board's latest decision, but still protect trade secret and confidential information?
Yeah, there's some examples. The National Labor Relations Board, the Acting General Counsel, earlier this year, and I believe May, issued a memorandum discussing various social media policies that it either approved or was criticizing. It actually did issue a kind of a sample social media policy towards the end of that memorandum. It is a good kind of general overview or template. However, it may not give clear, bright distinctions. It may not apply to all business industries, but it's a good template to take a look at and overview review the kind of the practical consideration which we're seeing in all these that the National Labor Relations Board is criticizing policies for is really that they're too overbroad in encompassing information that would be protectable under Section 7. And so the NLRB is recognizing that trade secret and confidential information could be protected, but it needs to really be, you know, specifically identified and tailored. So the main ultimate, you know, practical consideration is to really specify and give the employee examples of that information they can't disclose, for example, information regarding an unreleased product.
Thanks, Josh. And then lastly, two questions for you, Mike. What about no-hire agreements? Should prudent employers use those no-hire agreements?
I recommend no-hire agreements, but you need to check state law because it differs by state. But generally, I recommend no-hire agreements. But when no-hire agreements come up in the context of resolving a dispute or in discussions between competitors, great care needs to be taken because in the past 2 years, Justice Department has been focusing on no-hire agreements. There is the high-tech case with the Apple, Adobe, Google, those companies, and recently, as an offshoot of that, eBay, Intuit, agreements among competitors regarding the solicitation of employees, and the Justice Department has stated their view is that that violates antitrust concerns, and so one needs to be very careful when you tread in that territory and get sound advice before you do it.
Lastly, we have a question. What should you do if a newly hired employee informs you that they inadvertently took some of their former employer's data before they left?
The great lawyer answer, it depends. I think you'll need to talk to your professional legal advisor, but as a general practice, you want to get that information out of the hands of the employee, and you don't want to put it in hands of other people at the business. I would recommend putting it in the hands of outside counsel immediately and then deciding what to do with it. There may be several different options, from destroying it to returning it to hanging on to it to informing the new employer, former employer, not informing the former employer. There's a lot of consideration, so you need to be very careful there and tread very carefully.
Great. Thanks, Mike. And then lastly, please stay current on our trade secret blog. You can visit the blog at www.tradesecretslaw.com. And then please look for our registration for the next webinar in December on hot topics in California trade secret law. Have a great day.
Thank you again for joining us today. This concludes today's web conference. You may now disconnect.